have our last session, and the idea was a quest for wholeness, which is of course implicit in the whole of Krishnamurti's teachings. What's Krishnamurti aiming at is to restore, to regenerate the lost, if we ever had it, the lost sense of wholeness of humanity, the integrity, the truth, the goodness, right? Call it wholeness. He preferred the word wholeness because somehow it moves it a bit beyond the moral connotations of goodness. But he used to say also, goodness is a good word, isn't it? So the sense of goodness for him, as you can see, his religious intent was always very clear, right? And goodness is, you know, like you can say the science is aimed at truth, or a particular kind of truth, or art pursues beauty, religion pursues goodness, is about goodness. Pursue is maybe not the word, but the central aspect of it. These three, as you recall from our education, forming the trinity of the Platonic eternals, beauty, truth, and goodness. But as mankind is fragmented overall, this is our experience, right? We have described it already to some extent. The whole quest, therefore, is to see how we can understand, if possible, the factors of fragmentation, and therefore bring about wholeness by their dissolution in the light of insight. This is Krishnamurti's approach. Therefore, it's, as you know, a negative approach. We don't know if the negative approach works until we do it, right? Of saying, well, all right, if I'm violent and I pursue peace, then I won't have peace until I cease to be violent. So the understanding of violence itself becomes the factor of transformation of that conflictive and fragmentary movement. In his perception of the world, as I see it, beginning with the world and moving to relationship, which is closer to home, like we said, he not only gets it closer to home, but goes into the home, gets inside the house, as it were, which is human consciousness. It's all about consciousness. So this movement, an inner movement, an inner direction that he brings about, and essentially he places self-knowledge as the very nucleus ground of transformation. Says there is no wholeness without self-knowledge. You can pursue it in ideas and in practices and all kinds of things, but if you do not know yourself thoroughly and therefore dissolve as far as you can, well, actually he means totally, but we have to see where we are at ourselves personally in our lives, right? Without projecting any ideal. Unless that is, there's a freedom from those factors, then that wholeness doesn't come about. It will be just an idea. So what is consciousness? Therefore, he brings it to consciousness. How do I know myself? We've already had a hint, right? We watch, we see ourselves, we have mirrors, need mirrors. And the mirror of relationship was one of them that we already talked last time. And that is one of the most significant aspects of relationship, that it really is a mirror. It's where I can see my reactions, my values, my personality, all the particularities of my conditioning. So conditioning is also one key word that Krishnamurti uses. And we know very well, pretty much, it's a word that has really become very relevant in our time, particularly since the experiments of Pavlov and so on. What that fundamentally means is that we create, as it were, reflex structures, right? Like the knee-jerk in our consciousness also, by associated stimulus, right? You remember the dogs, Pavlov's dogs. The poor dog has a natural instinct, which is when there is food, it salivates. So that's altogether part of the intelligence that the body has developed in its evolution. Now, the good old Russians rang a bell every time he brought food to the dog or lit a light, turned on a light. So the dog was salivating, but he associated, because it was at the same time, the ringing of the bell or the lighting of the light of the lamp with the food. So then the cruel experimenter did not bring the food, but rang the bell or turned on the light, and the dog salivated still. I find that very scary, because he suggests that maybe psychologically we're doing the same to ourselves, that there's no real food in the imagination, in the mind. We are salivating for the bell and for the light and not for the food. That there is an obstruction that has been made and we are reacting to obstructions, and that this constitutes a danger, right? If the dog keeps doing that, it will starve. Maybe mankind, if it keeps doing that, that's the question, right? If it keeps doing that, if we keep salivating for artificial presentations of what is needful for our sustenance, then we will also starve. Maybe we are starving psychologically, emotionally, that we live on obstructions. Krishnamurti will bring it down to that. Are we living on obstructions? And is consciousness a grand construct of reflex system of obstructions built by thought? If so, then we have a major challenge, even from the mere Pavlovian perspective. But Krishnamurti says, well, therefore, what is consciousness, right? It's a question that Krishnamurti brings ultimately, where he brings it ultimately to, right? It is in the understanding of consciousness where transformation can take place, and self-knowledge is what we normally understand, the understanding of consciousness. But what is consciousness? I mean, look at it. It's complex, right? So I wouldn't pretend myself to be able to answer that question very well. We have already, since Freud and company, 100 years of psychology. We haven't figured it out yet, apparently, from that perspective. They're studying it. We continue to study. We have found certain things. Certain things are not there. Now there is the neurologist, the neuroscientist going at it. There's a whole revolution happening, apparently. Yes. But Krishnamurti said, yeah, they're still looking at the rat. And they're still poking the brain of this and the other. They're still looking at the monkey, but they're not looking at themselves. So he made a very simple objection. I said, boy, careful to go against science, right? But he said, no, you have to bring it home again, the whole thing. I think it's a bit of a theme of this seminar of ours, or workshop, which is, do the scientists understand themselves by understanding the rat? Do they understand themselves by putting all these electrodes in the brain and seeing how the right hemisphere operates with the left hemisphere? Or that remains knowledge. Remains still an obstruction, which still separates their knowledge from the actuality. So he wants to bring it, undo that division of the duality of the knowledge and the fact in relation to ourselves. That's also very beautiful, right? And he says, no, this is not a matter for specialists. This is a matter for each and every human being, because we have a consciousness, all of us, and that understanding is fundamental if we're going to be free from all these factors of fragmentation. Consciousness, as it stands, is fragmented. Is there a direct way? Is there a necessary, present way that you and I, as ordinary people who walk the streets, having no particular knowledge of or not having a lab in which to experiment, can actually proceed to undertake this journey of self-understanding? He says, yes, because consciousness is your daily life. You are that. If you observe, you will see. Sounds simple, but of course, we know very well already, right there, the bells are ringing of alarm saying, well, yes, we say the words, but just try it. Now, okay, trying to bring it again to make it simple, we say, what is consciousness? He used to make a pretty mysterious, seemingly mysterious or hollow statement, seemingly, which was, consciousness is its content. Now, what is that supposed to mean, right? So, consciousness is its content. Now, we think of consciousness as something a bit either the psychological structure or as something elevated, right? The word consciousness, and I think that may be relevant also to understand just the meaning of the word, and I think that's how Krishnamurti basically took it. The word itself is a compound of con, which means with or together, and science. So you look where a science is to be found. But science, the word itself, comes from sapientia, the Latin, which means knowledge. So consciousness, the very word, indicates the summation, the gathering of knowledge. And that's how Krishnamurti generally takes it, that consciousness is the field of the known. Therefore, fundamentally, the field of memory. There may be other aspects to it, but generally he distinguished also towards the end of his life between consciousness and mind. In most of his writings, that distinction does not exist. But it came along when Bohm, again, with his scientific mind and his capacity for fine distinctions, and of course he's very concerned with etymology, because Bohm considered that etymology is a kind of archaeology of meaning. The words are created with a particular meaning, and then they build sedimentations. But often, the original meaning of the word gives a clue to what it actually signifies. That is revealing, like the word consciousness. We generally don't look at that, do we? I just use it. He's conscious, he's unconscious. But I don't think about the content the word points to, which is the known. Interesting, no? The words sometimes have something to say by themselves. Again, the wisdom of the dictionary. Consciousness as the putting together, bringing together of knowledge. The putting together of knowledge, see, what is the content then that we can observe? What can we observe? Do I observe the content of consciousness, all the known? It's as it operates. So it's based on memory. So memory contains all the stuff. That's the content, right? The content is memory, right? So memory is like the operating system. But then from memory comes thought, right? Thought is part of consciousness. Consciousness, thought, memory are the intrinsic substantive elements, maybe, or operating. You can say memory is the substance. Thought is like the operating thing, the processing, the processor of memory. Now, curiously enough, I used to be rather fascinated by the fact that Kay usually started looking at the content of consciousness by looking at the emotional content. Not so much the intellectual, though they are bound by memory and thought, but the emotional content. What's the content of consciousness that we can see in the daily life as we proceed through the day? The emotions, three fundamental emotions he describes, which are pleasure, fear and sorrow. Well, there's pain also somewhere in there. I put sorrow because it's larger. But the consciousness contains these three fundamental emotional poles. Call it what you like, no? Poles. Pleasure, fear and sorrow or pain. Now, where we can see it is in one simple, very universal structure of the operation of thought, which is the movement of desire. See, that just seems natural to us, to desire. But Kay sees in it, actually, one of the most fundamental structures of consciousness as based on thought, as based on the past, and as creating the structure of self, which he perceives generally as the fundamental aspect of fragmentation. So it is if so, then it's important to understand desire, to understand pleasure, fear and sorrow, because they are factors of fragmentation as he sees them. Now desire, he used to go always into desire. He used to wonder also, why does he go into this? This is just how things are. We just desire, we just want things, we want pleasure, we want to avoid pain, therefore we have fear of this. And sorrow is also natural. You lose someone in your life, or you break a leg, or you don't succeed in your exams. Whatever it is, you see, there is all those sensations are natural. So what's the complication then? Why are these things complicated? So I remember once he sat down with us. He said, okay, let's look at desire. Look at desire. I never thought that you could look at it. Well, look at it. He said, well, what is it? How does it go? What actually happens? So it's a process. So that's the beauty of K also, shows processes at work in our normal everyday life. Hmm? And just the beauty of that, no? The possibility of that, that each of us has these processes. They also, and as a process, it has a beginning and so on, a development. It can be seen, it can be traced, right? It's causal, begins here, goes to this, goes to that, and then goes to this, and then it pursues that. But that's very nice. I said, wow, I never thought that consciousness had this kind of potential structure within it. Consciousness just comes and goes. A thought flits here and there, and so on. You see sort of patterns, more or less, but there are structures. So the content of consciousness is not only random memory here and there, but are these structures. There are these patterns of thought and feeling. So, desire, he said, all right. Suppose you see a car, the latest Mercedes. As you know, Krishnamurti was very fond of cars. So his desire had a very, very particular object, and it was called Mercedes. That was really funny. He used to laugh all himself, and he also liked blue shirts. So sometimes he would bring in, you see a blue shirt in a shop window, and he would sort of light his eyes like this, like, that was me. And so you see the blue shirt or the car, and you go into the shop. He was also like this. And you want to feel the material. So there is contact, right? So contact. And from the contact and the perception, the sight, you get a sensation. Oh, nice shirt, right? Then thought comes in. He says, thought comes in. So that's another step. And thought says, aha, I would like to have that shirt. It would look good on me. And he said, well, if you have the money, you buy it. Or not, depending, right? So there you go, the car, the same, right? He actually used to do this. He told us how in one time he was in the street and he saw this beautiful Mercedes model car. And the owner was there, so he went to the car and touched it. And he said to the owner, can I sit inside? He was childish in many ways, very childish. So the owner said, of course, sir. You know, because he had this presence, he had this incredible dignity. You see a man like him and he said, yeah, please sit in my car. So he sat in the car, felt it and so on, didn't take it for a drive, but he felt wonderful. But of course, he wasn't intent on buying anything like that, right? He already had his own Mercedes. Wasn't the latest model. And the Mercedes he had was a gift from a good friend of his. We just wanted to give him this pleasure of driving on the road at high speeds. He liked high speed also. And he said that was very conducive to meditation. Though he warned us, careful boys, girls, to drive and be in a state of meditation is very, very dangerous. You have to be very attentive because then you might lose sight of the road. But he could do it, you see, the master. He could drive a car at high speed and be in a state of meditation. So that's the process of desire. I just want to break it simple. Now, we were a bit dull, maybe a bit, we're not aware of all this process. So he felt that we were not catching it. So he said, all right, let me make it simple for you. Reduce it to sensation plus thought equals desire. So I actually went to my room and drew the formula. D, desire, equals T plus, no, S plus T. Sensation plus thought. Now, I think we can see that. And maybe we know it already from the description. This is what happens with everything that we desire. There's been some kind of contact with something. It could be also an idea. So we're talking about objects right now. So all these desires have to do with that a sensation, which of course is pleasant, right? What we desire is pleasure. So pleasure is already inbuilt in the very structure of desire, is the real object. The object is not the object. The object is the sensation that you will get from owning the object. So it's the pleasure, right? Now, sensation is fugitive, is passing, is fleeting, does not last, right? But thought picks it up, catches it in an image, the image of the shirt on the window, the image of the car, the image of the woman or the man, the image of the house, the image of myself in a podium, the image of myself as a writer, the image of myself as someone important, the image of myself in total security, the image of myself with money, the image of myself, the image. So the image encapsulates the sensation. And then what thought does is cultivates the image in order to produce that sensation, or further, it's the obtaining of the object. But fundamentally, it retains, it creates its own internal loop. We get caught in internal loops of desire, and there provide pleasure from the mere images that we conjure up. For Krishnamurti, this is itself an issue, because then we are depending for our happiness, becomes a dependence, right? Because it's pleasure that we can produce, we can reproduce. That's the thing. We are reproducing pleasure from the memory of it. From the memory we associate with pleasure. But that is in the past. So there you have the dog feeding itself on the memory of pleasure and confusing it with real happiness of the sensation. It's no longer living. It's all dead. So he sees already there, and as that becomes the central motivating force in our approach to almost everything, he feels there is a danger there in terms of the cultivation of the past. But if we're driven by images, and we talked a little bit about images yesterday in terms of relationship, but we also in our pursuits, in our motivations, we are also driven by images. We can also ask if that's just natural. And if that is not fundamental to doing anything in life, if desire to that degree is not really how we function. But you can see that there is an issue there in terms of depending, creating a dependence, a habitual pattern of thought, pursuing happiness through the cultivation of the sensations of memory. And then, of course, we look at the world that way. We look at everything that way. Dependent on pleasure. So pleasure is one major shaper of our lives. Krishnamurti used to say, our life, the society is pursuing pleasure. And we're pursuing pleasure in all the days of our lives. Isn't it true? There is pleasure, at least as a motivation, it kind of in the morning we have to make sure that some kind of pleasure is there. Right? A cup of coffee, whatever else, right? So pleasure, initially, of course, it just stands for the satisfaction of natural functions. Like the dog probably would experience pleasure, and as we do, when you are hungry and eat, right? There's the pleasure of sex, that's also there for the animal. It's just whenever it has to happen. So all these are natural. This is a natural component, not to be denied. But there's an artificial component brought about by thought, which lives, feeds these same sensations on the ashes of memory. This is where Krishnamurti says that we become dependent and we become dissociated, therefore, from the actual living present. And that very nucleus of craving, of law of desire, becomes the very driving force of the self. Therefore, everything is an object to me, because the image wants to satisfy itself. The self is the image. Slowly. This is complex. I see Nora shaking her head. Slowly, slowly. We'll discuss it. I have so many questions also around there. Huh? I'm trying to describe just the general picture. So, Joe, no. This is not dogma. Very good. So, I have also the same question. So, pleasure. But look at it. Just simple. The simple basis, right? The complex, how complex it gets in terms of understanding and what may be, if anything, wrong with it, right? That Krishnamurti tries to find out, is this a factor of fragmentation? Does it separate us from the whole of life by reducing our approach to life to memory? That's where he finally brings it, right? But that comes a little later. So pleasure, one aspect, the motivation, primary motivation, because that's where we seek happiness, right? But he says happiness is not to be found this way because it comes in inherently with his own fears, with his own frustrations. If we cultivate pleasure like this psychologically, The frustration is inherent. If I'm desiring to have a car, or I saw that car, but I don't have the money, but I want the car, then obviously, sexually, likewise, in terms of your position in society, your financial security, right? Walking around one day around my village in the evening, I used to go for a walk. And I realized suddenly one thing, that psychologically, thought was spinning around three fundamental poles. The pole of pleasure, the pole of security, and the pole of status. So to the observation of myself walking in the countryside, and without a theory, I had theories. See, this is the thing. The theory is one thing and it gets complicated. But to actually perceive that this is actually what thought is doing. What is thought doing psychologically in the emotional domain? What are we cultivating? What are the objects? Because thought has an object. Pleasure is an object. Security is another object. And status, your relative position in relation to others and the hierarchical structure of society is another. Because that's also part of security, that's also part of pleasure. They are really very connected. And this is the primary conditioning of psychological conditioning of mankind. You see it in the monkeys everywhere you go. Territoriality, security, the sexual drive, which is less in them because it's seasonal and so on, the reproduction, and the hierarchical structure within the group. That is there, and that is us. The monkey is still very active psychologically, but we don't see it very because it just takes that that's the way we are. That's the way we have been structured. But is it? Maybe physically, but psychologically now it's become a constant, cultivation of those things. This is the part of the issue. Why are we cultivating that psychologically the whole, not the whole time, but so often when there is no need, right? So need and greed, again, come back to us. Desire overshoots itself, pursues it beyond its natural domain, and becomes his own stimulation internally. Every evening, walking around the countryside, pleasure, security, status. Pleasure, security, status. Watch it. We're just that mechanical, that monkey-like, the living monkey. So thinking monkey, but the but thinking makes no difference to the monkey. It's still the monkey now in thinking, right? So that's the question. We'll discuss it in a minute. Fear. The monkey is afraid, naturally. You're afraid. We're all afraid. Fear has such a force, such a power, right? It has also to do with the future. The pleasure of desire is projected into the future. Fear is in relation to the future as something that threatens our security primarily, right? Fear goes very much with security. I want to secure what? My pleasure, my status, my security. So there you are. Those are the objects. This is what I want to secure. And fear is like the outpost watching out for danger. This is what it means in the dictionary. The word itself in English, fear, is associated with some Germanic root meaning danger. So in fact, the word itself contains danger in it. It's related to danger, closely related. And that's natural. The animal is also another instinctual reaction, to be afraid, right, of something that will destroy me, injure me, undermine my security, my health, anything like that. So this is the natural response of the animal, the famous flight, freeze, or fight. So there you are. Violence, again, connected with that too, as a self-defense, and so on. So fear, very fundamental. But Kay says, watch it, because here comes a subtler aspect. It is produced by thought, thinking about the future. It is thought again, psychologically. Physically, no, it's not thought, it's just a reaction. The dog, the neighbor's dog is aggressive and comes at me and I jump, right? Or I run away, whatever, or I kick it, right? Fight, flight, freeze. So there you are. This is natural instinctual reaction. But then thought goes on. So thought and pleasure are the product of thought. Fear and pleasure, I mean, are the product of thought. And that is time. So time, okay, brings it in, slips it practically under the door, is there. We live in time, psychological time. That's why he usually used to put this almost impossible, what he called, what you might call an impossible question, right? Can you live without a future? Psychologically. Can you live without a future? Because if there is no future, then there's no fear. But there's also no pleasure. Who wants to live without it? But they go together, because the projection of pleasure in the future is inherently uncertain. And you may be afraid to lose it if you have it, or not to get it if you don't. So fear is inbuilt in the in desire. So is pain. So is sorrow. Right? So sorrow is a major issue. And Kay, I think he saw it as very deep, as part and parcel of the current of the stream of consciousness. He called it the stream of sorrow, which is amazing to call it stream of sorrow. It goes, it's like a current that moves. Not just your life and my life. We all have sorrow. We still have it probably because it remains. It's still with us from some experiences, particularly the loss of people whom we said we loved. And the kind of securities we used to have, I don't know, all depends on the person. He has always his own object. But those things are very strong. Consciousness really feels profoundly the loss. The sense of loss is very strong. It's a shock to the system. Because we also, life is a vast network. Our life is dependent on a vast network of relations, right? You have my brother. My brother was one of my oldest brothers, was a great strength. I was the youngest. So he was always very protective. And I, all my life, whenever I was in any trouble or in any kind of at a loose end, there he was. Was a, one of the pillars of my existence. And he got a lung cancer and died. It was a horrible thing. I lost one of the pillars of my life. So sorrow. Tremendous. And he left me his little cottage. And every time I go there to Spain with a little cottage, I feel the absence. I feel an emptiness that I can't, you know, possibly make up for, because that house meant my brother. And he doesn't, is no longer. Right? Krishnamurti too lost his brother, right? Who was like his double in every way. So he used to say this, my brother was just like me. Whoa. If there were two of them, that would have been something. But he died also, very young, right? So he lost. Apparently Krishnamurti broke down completely. So that he, you know, yeah, it was disconsolate, completely disconsolate. Luckily he was on a boat and he could retire on a ship and he could go into India for the Golden Jubilee of the Theosophical Society. So he could retire to his cabin and just cry his heart out by himself, crying for his brother. But apparently, this was the art of the old man. I don't know if I can do it or if any one of us can, but this is what he's suggesting all the time. That if you stay with sorrow to the end, go to the very bottom. Don't separate yourself from it. Because he's just used to say, you are sorrow. Sorrow is the nature of the me because of its attachments. And the loss of attachment is the sorrow, psychologically speaking. Right? The shock is real also physically, because we do lose something important. But psychologically, we are attached to it. And therefore, the freedom from attachment is also the freedom from sorrow. But we won't know that until we go through the sorrow to the bottom. Likewise with fear. To stay with fear is such is an art also. And to go to the end of fear. Kay was a master of endings. He always asked these impossible questions. Can you live without fear? Therefore, come to the end of fear, because we have it. Can you live without sorrow? But we have it. So is there an end to it? Is there a way of penetrating to the depth of these things in our stay by staying with them, not separating ourselves from them, not seeking remedies, not seeking escapes? This is terrible, you see, because then you have to stay with the pain. You have to really live it, be it. But if it is just a memory, why wouldn't it explode? into some kind of beauty, into some kind of energy. That's what he suggested, that for him anyway, sorrow, if you go to the bottom of it, explodes into passion, the passion of beauty. In fact, becomes compassion. So there is an alchemy that is possible psychologically, according to him, in terms of facing all these things deeply, like fear. Right? Hold your horses. Krishnamurti presents some really extreme, transformative proposals, right? Very extreme. All of this is moved by thought. And as you know, Kay brought basically the whole field of fragmentation into the field of thought because of the intrinsic limitation he saw in it, right? By his definition. I'm not sure if thought is that limited, but that's how he saw it, right? That thought is the response of memory. And memory, of course, is of the past. So thought is not able, if it's just rooted in that, tethered to the past, right? It can't reach beyond that border, unless something else, of course, informs it differently, which would be awareness or perception or insight. But by itself, it can only repeat. So that also suggests that thought, as the response of memory, is inherently conditioned. So again, it cannot move beyond that border. This is not free, not essentially free, in relation to meeting life as a whole. Cannot, because this moment now is not covered by the past. It's moved beyond it already. This is a great paradox about that life, that every moment is beyond the past, and yet we approach it with knowledge. Therefore, not comprehending the full dimension of our lives. We're missing our lives. That's a big question, right? Or the wholeness of it, rather, right? We have our lives, so let's not deny what we got. But there it is. Thought, if that is the fundamental factor of our lives, knowledge operating from the known, which is consciousness, consciousness as the known, if that is the nucleus of our existence, then the past is the dominant factor. And as such, is missing the fullness of the present. What it can cultivate is from that past. It pursues happiness within that past by cultivating pleasure. But pleasure is not happiness or joy, because joy is always of the timeless now. This is how Krishnamurti puts the kind of dichotomy that is operating in our functioning. So to see through that, the limitation of thought is very important. That is also the limitation of time, right? So that's why I said, can you live without time? Whoa, no, we can't. Chronologically, at least we can't. But psychologically, what would it mean, right? To put time in its right place also, he would say, right? Because knowledge has its place. So you can't just throw it out the window. It's a question of not throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Let's throw out the bathwater, but keep the baby. The baby is science has its place, but then there's a lot of bathwater in terms of the whole psychological rumination of living in the past, right? And the self is, that's past also. He even brings the self, which is our identity, to that domain. What we think is most alive in us, that represents the free, the perceiver, the thinker, the experiencer, he sees still as belonging to the domain of the known. It's a little trick that thought performs upon itself, whereby it separates itself into two, and disguises one as not belonging to the past, the thinker. But he says, ha-ha, watch it. I am not that subtle, but he was that subtle, wherein he could perceive, apparently, that actually the thinker does not exist without thought. It's not its product. It itself is the product of thought, and as such is the projection of memory. So it's memory that looks at itself but says, I'm not memory. If that's the case, then we have, at the center of consciousness, a real dangerous deception. That at least is the question that it puts to me in my life. Are you, sir, like used to say to everybody, are you, sir, deceiving yourself about what you are? So also the self is what I am, right? What am I? So I say, I am so and so. I have this shape, a photo in my passport, and I have this content of consciousness, this conditioning, particular conditioning, personal conditioning, the personality. Then what do I do with that? Internally, I identify with a set of qualities, right? The good, the beautiful, the virtuous, the talented. So I say, oh, yes, this, this, this. But of course, I'm all the others also. I'm deceiving myself. I'm greedy. I'm lustful. I'm proud. I'm aggressive. I'm blah, blah. The seven deadly sins are there with me still. So there you are. I'm all this. But you have this self that I need to present as acceptable, even to myself. And then what you psychologists call the disowned self, right? The one that I want to reject. So already the notion of self as identification with a set of qualities implies duality. Not only the observer and the observed, but even within the very image of the self, there is duality. So Krishnamurti used to say, well, if you realize that, yes, you are this talent and you have this thing and this other, all those good qualities, but you also are the other, turn by turn, right? You turn around the corner and the beautiful turns into the ugly. The virtuous turn into the vicious. The peaceful turns into the violent. The beautiful, etc. The whole thing goes on turning, right? So he says, since you realize that this is a stream of qualities and that you are all that, then you're also none of them. Therefore, you are nothing. You're no thing. You're no quality. You cannot put to the I am an X and fill the X, the variant, right? Because it's varying, it cannot hold the identity, right? I found that very insightful and beautiful suggestion. Watch the stream of qualities. Don't identify with one as opposed to the other, because the variant is always changing. The variant of the I am X, right? We fill in the X and try to fix it, but the X keeps changing its content, right? So you are one thing, another, another. At the end, you are none of those. You cannot choose. And that's why he puts the, at the end of the day, as you know, the question of choice for him psychologically is a mistake. Is in fact the denial of wholeness, because it was fragments. And that's why his solution was something apparently very simple and seemingly very difficult to carry out, which is to be choicelessly aware of this whole movement of the variants of our lives and also of the structures that those variants reveal. The structure of thought, the structure of desire, structures of pleasure, fear, and so on. The whole movement of abstractions that thought and consciousness creates. Choiceless awareness, the choice, as we saw in the self at least, is what divides. But maybe it's so everywhere. And in fact, the perception that chooses is already a fragmentation of the totality of what is. So this is his approach. Is there an approach to wholeness, to restore wholeness? And he says, try this.